Welcome to the one show that takes you where others won't. Out into the wilderness, past the frontiers of current sales techniques and technologies to discover what's new. Hey, Will Crist, your international sales trainer.
Well, welcome to Pilgrim Talks on the Pilgrim on the 405 on this beautiful sunshiny day in Southern California. A couple of weeks ago, I began looking into the whole notion of customer service and wanted to find out what companies in Southern California are doing to improve their customer service. And in order to do that, I began to ask folks who has exhibited to them exemplary customer service. One of the ways that I looked around was through a very interesting, service called Help a Reporter Out. You can put out a huge query to folks all around the country asking for help, asking for information, asking for people to interview. And interestingly enough, in doing that, I got introduced to a wonderful organization in Southern California. The Credit Union of Southern California has a tremendous value that it places on customer service. And as I had a chance to talk with Dave Gunderson, the CEO and president of the Credit Union in Southern California, I was overwhelmed with the value that he puts on customer service and what he's done over the past couple of years to make that a central part of his business plan. And I wanted to invite Dave onto the show so he could not only tell us what he does, tell us how he does it, and also to tell us the wonderful results that he's getting from that. So, Dave, welcome. Welcome to Pilgrim Talks.
Thank you, Will. It's a pleasure to be here, and along with me is Michelle Hunter, our Senior Vice President of Marketing.
Great. That's wonderful. It was a good, wonderful time to be with both you and Michelle. So I want you to tell us a little bit about what it is that you do with customer service. What kind of how is this central to your business offering?
Well, at Credit Union of Southern California, we serve 42,000 members, customers, but we call them members. And service clearly is a strategy and not a function. We measure it about 8 different ways, and it's central to everything we do. Perhaps the most important measurement associated with our service is connected to something called the Net Promoter Score. There's a case study out by Harvard, and it's called The One Number You Need to Grow, and that's the Net Promoter Score. And many Fortune 500 companies are using this, many credit unions, many banks are using it. And essentially, you call customers or members that had a recent transaction with you, and you ask them, on a scale of 1 to 10, would they refer a friend or family member? And 9s and 10s are promoters. Well, in the financial industry, banks are scoring at about 11%, and credit unions are scoring at about 55%. The 75% mark is considered to be good or great. Fortunately, we're scoring about 81%. And why that's important to us is this, and the case study reflects this. The Net Promoter Score is truly the one number connected to growth and profitability and building better lives for your employees and your customers. So that's the central focus for us. That would be the Net Promoter Score.
And as a senior team member, Will, I can share that, as Dave mentioned, service is a strategy. And the ways in which on the senior team we execute that is we'll run initiatives by one another and often ask, before we execute this, how does this improve the lives of our members or employees? How is this going to build better lives? Will this make a difference? Will this differentiate the credit union? It's not a matter of the profitability per se on the credit union side. The question often first asked is, how is this going to improve the lives of our member owners and or our employees? And I think that's a testament to the fact that it is part of our strategy.
Well, that's wonderful. Tell me a little bit about how you, what is it that you do to implement this?
Literally about 10 different strategies. I'll give you a few of the highlights. We have a service committee It meets twice a year. We have subcommittees. We have a service experience team, a service resolution team, a service measurement team. At quarterly chats, where I meet with team members at various locations, the focus is on how can we build better lives for our employees and members. At every staff meeting, we have one tomorrow, half or more of the focus is on providing radical levels of service. So it runs in our DNA. Virtually everything we communicate to our team members revolves around providing world-class service.
Talk a little bit more about some specific examples of what you do to improve your customer service.
Well, I think a premier example can be found by the way we answer our phones. If you call most organizations, most financial institutions, usually the phone rings several times. Usually it takes a minute plus to talk to a representative. At Credit Union of Southern California, we're answering approximately 92% of calls before the phone even rings, and we do not use an automatic call attendant. Our call center representatives pick up those phones immediately and are able to answer most calls. Now, your listeners hopefully won't all call in at one time and prove me wrong and overwhelm our phone center, but that is indeed what we've been able to achieve the last few years.
All right, so that's one. That's wonderful. That he keeps from having to push all those buttons and get lost, get frustrated, and start shouting for agent, right?
That would be correct. And I think for any organization, it's just vital to try to find a way to differentiate yourself. And we radically differentiate on the service level. My youngest son, Kyle, when he was about 7 years old, my wife and I were watching him pour milk on top of the Rice Krispies he was about to eat, and he poured a little milk, and then he poured more milk on it, and then he'd put his ear down and pour more milk on it and put his ear down, and finally he just dumped the rest of the carton on the Rice Krispies, put his ear down, and then pumped his fist and said, "Now they're talking." The bottom line is for us at the Crane of Southern California, the best marketing we can do is to get our members talking about our service. And that's what we're finding when we survey our members and when we open new memberships, which is about 500 a month. Over half of them found out and decided to join our organization because somebody was talking about us. They were referred.
And Will, you said 500 a month,
right,
are being referred to you. Is that a little or a lot?
Well, I guess you'd have to look at that in context. Our membership growth rate is above peer group credit unions. We think it's a lot, but it's relative to other credit unions, I would say about 15 to 20% higher than what would be normal.
Okay. Michelle, you were saying?
Oh, I was just going to dovetail onto that. And part of the ways in which we get our members talking positively about their experiences at CU SoCal is we ensure that team members and our members, when they come into a branch or call us on the telephone, that they have a positive experience. And we like to have fun. We enjoy celebrating together. If the credit union achieves a financial milestone, it is celebrated throughout the credit union and out to the members. We recently celebrated a milestone hitting a financial target that we had set for ourselves. And we not only surprised staff with incentives and fun perks, we went to our membership and we celebrated. We had food in the branches, we had balloons, we had banners, we gave away gift cards to local restaurants just randomly. Just to honor them and to thank them for their loyalty, we couldn't be where we are today without them, and we recognize that. And so we put forth a lot of our limited marketing budget in ensuring that experience is a positive one and rewarding our members/customers for their loyalty and their reference, their word-of-mouth reference.
Well, would you have any interest in sharing that milestone? We can celebrate a little bit here.
Well, we, in 1 month, earned a net promoter score of close to 90%. And we also hit a very high net income target and a regulatory reserve target. So we're hitting our financial goals and we're hitting our service goals. And most importantly, we're seeing evidence that we're building better lives. You know, in the end, I want to emphasize it's not all about the numbers, Will. Graveyards grow, and I've never heard anyone say, hey, that graveyard's growing quickly. I mean, in the end, people don't want to be a part of something, even if the numbers are good. They want to be part of something that's building better lives. And I believe it's truly in our DNA, and I believe it's in who we hire. We hire people that we believe really care about building better lives.
And we believe our financial success is just the byproduct of our focus on doing the right thing for our employees and for our members. And so that's fun to see. That's kind of a measurement, if you will, indicating whether we're doing the right thing. And if we are making a difference for our members and employees, are we building better lives? And that's kind of our report card, if you will, the finances. But that's not our primary focus. We're not focused on getting an A on that report card. We're focused on putting forth the effort. You know, do the right thing, study hard. In the report card, which is the financial results, will dictate how well you did in preparation, how well you prepared, how well you made a difference in members' lives.
Well, that's wonderful. Now, so this morning I was speaking with one of the vice presidents at Serious Decisions in Connecticut, and he works with significant companies anywhere from $2 million a year to several billion dollars a year, and he was sharing with me some interesting insights as to what needs to be in alignment in the company to thrive. And we talked about four different areas, one of them being customer service. Now, as a Sandler trainer, I spend a lot of time working with the sales part of an organization and help the sales organization get clear about, that their task is of course, selling and bringing in revenue, getting a purchase order, or in your case, getting a deposit is important. But I would agree with you, Michelle, that's the byproduct of the real goal, which is to meet the needs of the customer.
It is. Well, and in fact, we have four top scorecard goals that our credit union monitors monthly. And the very first one is our net promoter score. We do have alignment goals, which I believe you were just referencing, and those all feed into that. For example, that might be, as Dave mentioned, how quickly do we answer those phone calls? Those would be our alignment goals, but our very first priority is our net promoter score.
Will, I was fortunate about 8 years ago to be able to go to the Harvard Business School for a week. And from sunup to sundown, we studied the characteristics of great companies. And throughout that week-long educational process, the focus was on alignment. And the great companies, those that over 15-plus years outgrow their competition and out-earn them, they have tremendous alignment. And at CU SoCal, Creighton in Southern California, our alignment all leads up into building better lives through providing world-class service. So whether it's a newsletter article, someone we're hiring, a meeting, whatever we're doing, we need to make sure that we're aligned with providing world-class service to our members. So I think that executive you talked to was spot on when he talked about alignment.
So talk to me a little bit about what your plans are for not just the next 6 months, 9 months, next year. Over the longer term, what kind of goals do you have? Is it a growth goal? Is it the same report card goal that you have now? Where do you want to lead the company?
We do have long-term growth goals, not because size will allow us to pump our fist. We know that as a larger size institution or organization, we can provide more value to our employees and our members. But in the end, we know that we get to those growth goals by building better lives. We have a long-term goal to sustain a net promoter score of at least 80%. We know if we achieve that, we will be differentiating, and the long-term asset growth goals, the long-term earnings goals will all fall into place. So the focus is on service, and we know the numbers will come. But we do have, you know, specific measurable long-term goals.
Well, now, when you look at those financial goals, I mean, in talking to other financial institutions, what I'm hearing is that a number of institutions are hitting their deposit goals in terms of getting new deposits. They're not anywhere near hitting their loan goals. And what I'm told, not being a banker, I'm listening, and what I hear is that their revenue really does come from the loans. And so with up the loans, they're not looking at the kind of revenue growth that they wanted to have. Is that true for you?
Well, it is true that the financial industry is challenged with loan growth. That is also very true for Creighton of Southern California. However, I do believe there's ways to generate strong earnings without strong loan growth, and we are doing that. Our earnings right now are at a record level, and that's in part due to the number of new memberships we're opening, and those memberships, the number of checking accounts they're opening, the value we're providing. We have no fee checking across the board, and those checking accounts produce revenue. There's a great case study about Commerce Bank, one of the fastest growing, most profitable banks around. They were unfortunately acquired many years ago, but they did not focus on loans. Now, I believe loans are important, but I don't believe they're critical to long-term growth and profitability. I believe if you're providing radical levels of service, you'll bring in a very high number of memberships and checking accounts that will produce the revenues to achieve the financial goals of the organization.
So you really do believe in this customer service focus?
I do, for many reasons. First and foremost, we're trying to change lives. One of the things that we've talked about before is we try to treat ordinary people like royalty. I'm going to England next week for the first time, and talk about royalty. Well, we know about that there, but it doesn't have to flow through your blood to be treated like royalty. And it's fun to build better lives by treating ordinary people like us will, like royalty. And in the end, if you do that, everyone will win. You'll achieve your financial goals, lives will be changed, and the organization will grow. And we've been fortunate enough to experience growth and profitability as a result of truly wanting to build better lives.
That's wonderful. Is it possible for you to share a couple examples of what you mean by building better lives?
Well, I guess there's two prongs to that, for employees and then for our members / customers. For employees, our growth and profitability, we've just not had to lay off. And I would say that's a way through this tough, turbulent time in our economy. We haven't laid off. Not only have we not laid off employees, we've given raises and we've made contributions to their 401k plans. So the service has produced the financial strength for us to build better lives for our employees by keeping their jobs, giving raises, and contributing to their 401ks. And I would say through the work environment, we have a fun work environment. We care, and I think most of us enjoy working here. For our members, the service we've provided has changed lives. We care about the members' stories. We try to solve their challenges quickly, and we also, through our financial strength, don't have to charge, for example, monthly checking fees. So there's a lot of things that we can do. And in the end, we think we're building better lives with our members and employees because we have what's called an engaged team society, and our employees and our members, I believe they're engaging with each other. And when you engage in any activity, usually there's a certain amount of fulfillment, which means building better lives to us.
Well, your enthusiasm certainly is transparent. I mean, it comes through very clearly that this is not only a business strategy, but it's a personal strategy.
That's spot on.
Would you be willing to share a little bit about what this means to you at a more personal level?
cover briefly what we talk about at almost every team meeting, because it applies to me so much on a personal level. And that's, there's a story behind every face. And when you think about that, Will, if you're passionate about finding out what someone's story is, you're going to be slower to judge them, slower to criticize them. And I can be better positioned to build a better life if I try to understand the story behind every face. I've shared many stories where, for example, I've been cut off on the freeway and get frustrated and have maybe not thought some really nice things about the person cutting me off. But what if that person was late to their final exam and they'd been up studying all night and I was on my cell phone driving slowly? Understanding the story behind every face is personally really important to me. Now, I'm guilty as charged sometimes. I may not think about the story, but I'm personally passionate when it comes to finding out what your story is, what anyone's story is, because then I can be better positioned to build a better life for you.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. And you say you share stories like this around the table at your staff meetings?
At quarterly chats, at staff meetings, we're constantly sharing stories related to there's a story behind every face. Yeah, it is a big part of our philosophy and our manifesto, if you will.
Uh-huh. Now, the kind of direction that you have is not the kind of direction or the core value that you talk about. That's not the stated core value of every financial institution that I've met. You must have some strong support from your senior leadership team as well as your board.
We do. I believe there's alignment and support across the organization, from our board to our supervisory committee, to our management, to all team members. And when it comes down to it, I think we're all in alignment with what we would call the higher calling, and that is to build better lives. I think in any organization, for it to be successful, for it to grow, to achieve the financial goals, every effort has to be made to make sure you have a higher calling. You know, why are you here? Why did you get out of bed today? Why are you at work? Is it to get a paycheck? Well, that's part of it, but hopefully it's about the higher calling. Our board members, they're not paid. They're volunteers that spend on average 4 to 10 hours a month volunteering their time to build better lives. And I gotta believe that they believe in the higher calling of building better lives for our 42,000 members.
You know, that comes very close to be talking about purpose.
That's right, and I think too many organizations, and I suppose sometimes we're guilty of this, we get too wrapped up in the day-to-day, and you can get too wrapped up in the numbers, and that's getting it backwards. When you focus on the numbers, you might succeed over a 6 to 12-month period, for example, but long-term, most great organizations don't focus on the numbers. They know long-term they've got to focus on the higher calling, and that the numbers will flow if they are focused on that.
That was certainly borne out by the Good to Great, wasn't it? And then also Built to Last. It's the companies that have a core purpose, a central purpose, that they keep coming back to in thick and thin, whether it's good times or bad times. They have a core purpose, and that's more than just to survive.
That's right. And Collins, in his book, Good to Great, you know, he had the three circles. I don't know if you remember that. And he asked, you know, what are you deeply passionate about? What are you the best in the world about? What are you the best in the world at? And what drives your economic engine? And we're passionate about building better lives. And we're not saying we can be the best in the world, but we try to be the best in the world at service. What drives our economic engine? Well, there's a few products that do that, but we're definitely a Collins fan, and we're definitely passionate about service and building better lives.
Well, with the numbers that you're talking to me and the numbers that you shared, you're not too shabby.
No, there's a little over 400 cranes in California and a little over 7,000 in the country, and when you look at their earnings level and net worth, In California, we're in the top five, and in the United States, out of the 7,000 plus, we're in the top 35. And I credit that to everyone, not just management. It's all team members, board members, supervisory committee members, focusing more on the higher calling than the numbers. And I'm not going to deny, the numbers are important to me. I'd be lying if I said otherwise.
Oh, of course not.
But the greater
it has to do with what takes priority, where you see the leverage. Is the leverage that we will have good customer service when we have the numbers up, then we can afford it, or we have good customer service and we believe that's what drives the revenue?
Correct.
Well, you know, we probably have a good mutual friend here in Orange County who doesn't have a financial institution, but he does tend to talk a lot about a purpose-driven life.
Yeah, our friend Mr. Rick Warren.
That's right. That's right. Does that have any influence in your organization?
I've read his books.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. Well, you know, we're coming to the end of our time together here, and this has been a wonderful, just the experience of meeting with you and Michelle was wonderful, and to know that you are actively looking to build better lives. That's a wonderful statement, and my question is, I wonder how we could make that a purpose for a larger number of people, not only to build their businesses, although we believe it would, but also to begin to look at the larger, the metropolitan area, the County of Orange, and how we could help to build better lives throughout the county.
Well, you know, we look to a lot of organizations for strategies. We're a learning organization. We've learned so much from other credit unions, for example, and we try to reciprocate. And we've had an open door to other organizations wanting to come in and attend our team meetings, to attend our Service from the Heart training. And so that is available to other organizations if they want to send one or two employees at a time to see what our environment's like. And hopefully they would open the door for us to come see what they do. We don't have all the answers, and we're always striving to be better. And we know things are a-changing. One of the quotes I like is, if you don't like change, you're going to like your relevance even less. And we're going to, at CU SoCal, do everything we can to keep learning and to open our doors to others to see what we're doing.
Well, let's the three of us work together to find some ways to open this dialogue up to more people. Does that make sense?
Yes, indeed.
We appreciate that.
Wonderful. Now, if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, it should be pretty obvious how to do it, but tell us.
You can go to our website, which is www.cusocal.org, cusocal.org. You can learn more about us and our organization there.
Or they can call the credit union, the numbers listed on the website, and ask for Michelle Hunter, we will set up training meetings.
Absolutely. Wonderful. It's been wonderful talking with Dave Gunderson, the president and CEO of Credit Union of Southern California, and his wonderful PR person, Michelle Hunter. Thanks a lot for being with us today.
Thank you. It's our pleasure.
Thank you, Will.
And there you have it, one of the wonderful institutions in Orange County that is certainly looking to increase the quality of life in Orange County. That is a song to my heart to hear all of that. So I want to thank you, thank the two of them for being with us, and thank you for being with us. And before we get on to our next segment, which is to look at and to hear and talk about what keeps CIOs up at night and what can be done about that, we'll have Kelly O'Connell and Dave Cunningham talking about that. But first, a word from our sponsors.
Hi, I'm Bob Barber with Sandler Training. I'm here to talk to you about rule number 6. Don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today. I was talking to a salesperson the other day, and he'd closed a big deal. Gone to the bank, cashed the check, the works. Unfortunately, he got a 4 o'clock in the morning phone call from a prospect saying, put a hold on things, something's come up. He'd had second thoughts. Second thoughts. Have you ever had second thoughts? Of course you have. It's human nature. It's usually right after you let your daughter stay out late on Friday night, or you order dessert or buy that new car. Did I make the right decision? It's only human nature. Traditional salespeople tend to rush through that process, hope that the person doesn't have their human nature natural reaction of second thoughts or buyer's remorse. They try to close the deal, pass that problem on to somebody else, get that contract processed. At Sandler, we help the prospect embrace that. Bring it up. Help them go through it. Work through that second thought, that buyer's remorse. It might sound something like, Jim, I'm looking forward to working with you. I think it's going to be fun. This accounting solution is what your company needs. Now, you were a little concerned that we couldn't get the conversion in place within 3 weeks. It's going to be more like five. Are you going to be okay with that? Help that person work through it. What better way to reinforce the role of a trusted advisor than to help that person work through their buyer's remorse? Rule number six, don't buy back tomorrow what you sold today.
Well, welcome to the second half of Pilgrim Talks on this beautiful, sunny afternoon in Laguna Beach. And we have some very interesting things to talk about because the Robert Half Group has spent some time investigating from, goodness, over 1,400 CIOs to find out what keeps them up at night. So we're going to have Kelly O'Connell with us to talk a little bit about that report, and we're also going to have Dave Cunningham from Dempsey Bluvar, and Dave is one of those people who calls on these CIOs to see if he can help them sleep better at night. So I want to bring both on. Kelly, welcome to Pilgrim Talks.
Thank you.
And welcome, Dave.
Yes, thank you.
So let's start a little bit. Tell us a little bit, Kelly, if you could tell us a little bit about what you do, and then we'll go to Dave and let him talk. So tell us a little bit about what you do at Robert Half.
Absolutely. I'm the Metro Market Manager for Robert Half International. I manage a team of staffing professionals, recruiting and sales consultants for the Torrance and Orange County marketplace.
And tell us a little bit about this CIO Insomnia Report, would you?
Absolutely. The CIO Insomnia Report is one of Robert Half's regularly scheduled surveys where we interviewed 1,400 CIOs from across North America on a number of workplace and career management issues to understand what's keeping them up at night so we could share those findings with clients and candidates and the general public.
All right. And now, Dave, tell us a little bit of what Dempsey Bluvar does and why you have a particular interest in what keeps CIOs up at night.
Well, thank you. Yeah, Dempsey Bluvar is a managed services provider, IT services provider, and we typically work with mid-market CFOs, CEOs, and CIOs to help them manage their IT infrastructure so that they can focus on their business. In the case of CIOs, we oftentimes will assist them with projects and perhaps selectively outsourcing functions within IT. So we're always interested, and we need to be very focused on those issues that are of most interest, that are most important to CIOs.
All right. So, Kelly, tell us a little bit about what you have found. I mean, how many did you interview?
1,400 C-level executives.
Wow. So what did you find?
We found that most CIOs cited data security, hardware, operating systems, and staffing as their top concerns, which probably isn't that surprising to people. Data security has definitely been in the news recently, and staffing has certainly been an issue that we've heard quite a lot about in the news recently.
And so when I read the report, it said to me that 24% of these people said that data security was their most important issue, right?
Absolutely. So nearly a quarter, 24% of CIOs that we interviewed cited data security as their primary concern, which was followed by hardware and operating systems at 13% of CIOs.
So upgrading hardware and operating systems, I wonder why that is something that keeps them up at night.
Well, what we found is that it went in conjunction with staffing shortages and IT having staffing freezes over the last 2 years, that maintaining the level of software and hardware within their workplace and additional projects of upgrading hardware and software in their workplace on already lean teams
could be problematic for them.
I see. So, Dave, does this speak anything to what you bring to the marketplace for CIOs?
Certainly, in the case of staffing shortages, CIOs may be looking to organizations like Robert Half and Associates to augment their staffs, or they may be looking to IT services providers to implement projects. And there is a trend in the mid-market to outsource the management of the infrastructures to managed services providers such as ourselves. So we're seeing that, and then with the data security concerns, it seems like there are really two areas there that they're concerned about. They're concerned about their existing infrastructure, what is the security of their existing infrastructure, and how do they maintain that? And then certainly they're getting a lot of pressure from the business units to consider cloud computing initiatives, and there's quite a bit of unknown about the security of that kind of a strategy.
Okay. So now what I'm hearing is that for the CIO who's concerned about the heavy workloads or the projects around upgrading hardware operating systems, that there's at least two solutions. One is bringing on additional staff, which, Kelly, you could help them with, right?
Absolutely.
And the other option is outsourcing, which, Dave, you can help them with.
Yes, sir.
Now, a friend of mine and I, Dave Kinnear, and I have been talking about what we see going on in the marketplace in terms of technical people, because what we've been observing is that with the downsizing that happened over the last couple of years, that more and more people are seeing themselves as outsourced. They take on a variety of projects. They're not really interested in being hired by one particular corporation or one particular company. Either of you finding that to be true? Kelly, do you see that happening?
Well, I would say that 63% of the CIOs on our survey said that understaffing somewhat affected their company's ability to implement innovative technologies. I've also found in personal experience in working in this industry that many companies cut their IT staff very deeply during the economic downturn, and as a result were stretched very thin. So they were reprioritizing existing projects with existing lean teams, which does result in individuals taking on additional workloads. It's also, as the market has started to pick back up, resulted in many candidates and clients alike who are exploring contract to hire or consulting services project arrangements rather than hiring full-time headcount directly.
Uh-huh. So they might be hiring individual people to take on projects or freelancers.
Absolutely.
Now, is that something that you can help people do, is identify a freelancer for a part-time position?
Absolutely. Core to what Robert Half does is provide clients with contract to hire, as well as direct hire staffing models.
Now, what have you been observing in terms of your asset base, your people out there? Are more people looking for corporate jobs now, percentage-wise, in terms of the base of people, or do you see a rise in the number of people who want to stay contracting?
You know, we found that both of our groups of business, both our contract to hire and direct hire practices, are showing a positive uptick in this quarter, which is wonderful news for the economy in general. But we've also found that 1 in 10 CIOs have said managing heavy workloads is their top concern, which means that there's space, I believe, for both project work and direct hire staffing as we continue to see the year progress.
Uh-huh. So, Dave, how about you? What are you finding out? You have to hire people from time to time to put into your staff, right?
Yes, we do. And one of the challenges that we have is taking IT staff that have traditionally worked for a single organization as a member of an IT staff, bringing them into a service provider's environment which has a different culture and a different pace, and then working with them to develop the skills to work with multiple clients, and to, you know, bill for their time and be a go to being essentially a delivery or a deliverer of the services that we provide. Mm-hmm. And so that there's a lot of opportunity, there's a lot of talent available in the marketplace, but it is somewhat of a cultural shift for somebody to go from having worked for a single company to working for a service provider.
So they would be more along the lines of, not with regard to you, but with regard to their job description, they would be more like what a contract to provider would be to a company.
Oh, yes. Yeah, I would agree.
They'd have several projects they're working on. All right, now,
I would agree.
So, Kelly, tell me, what else did you find out? What were the what do you have? What were the top five IT concerns?
So again, data security being the primary concern, followed by hardware and operating system upgrades. CIOs were also concerned about the implementation of projects that had been on the pipeline. One in 10 said heavy workloads was a critical concern for them. And many IT departments and IT C-levels have also said that finding the right talent is a concern. So many IT departments are having a hard time recruiting and filling specific roles that they do have open when they become open.
Why do you think they're having a hard time recruiting?
Well, while I agree with David, in some areas there are levels of quality talent in the marketplace, IT staffing shortages aren't across the board, and IT staffing availability is also not available across the board. In specific functional areas, particularly in those areas that are associated with their top concerns, in data security, in systems upgrades, in experience with the newest technologies, with these very specific skill sets, the market is actually very lean with quality talent available. Simultaneously, you do have an area where if a company does post an open position, he or she who posts it may be inundated with resumes, which can make it challenging to identify the candidate that's going to be the best fit for their environment.
Uh-huh.
when they're trying to sort through all of those resumes, and they have their typical job that they're also trying to do.
Right.
You know, and I was going to echo Kelly. You know, one of the things that's really ironic and interesting is that, you know, there had been a slowdown in the economy, and we're seeing that turn around. But while the economy slowed down, the pace of technological innovation did not slow. There's been just an explosive and disruptive change in the way that IT is delivered to end users. And just as one example would be the proliferation of devices that must be supported, such as smartphones. I mean, that's just one example. So we've had this slowdown in the economy, but the job descriptions are changing, and I think that probably leads to some of the scarcity that Kelly is talking about. And that's really challenging for a CIO to keep pace with the technological change at the very same time they don't have the budgets for staffing.
Absolutely, Dave. And convergence technology, as you described, the move towards mobile data consumption increases both that data security risk as well as the need for support professionals who are experienced in supporting that technology, and the pace at which those people are available hasn't become more readily available in spite of the fact that in many areas in our market economy there were high unemployment areas. In these specialized skill sets, there is true, and you used a great word, scarcity for those skill sets.
But what I'm hearing, Kelly, and correct me if I'm wrong, what I'm hearing is that while the skill set that a person needs to have might be scarce in the marketplace, there's no scarcity of people who would like to pretend or get the hiring company to believe that they could do it if they had a chance.
I believe that people want the opportunity to step up. And so I don't know that most people who apply to a position believe that they're pretending. I believe that people have been trained and taught apply and then find a way to learn this skill. Hmm. Apply and then find a way to earn the right to the seat with just a really positive work ethic. Mm-hmm. And I believe that's part of what a good screening process goes through, is helping those people to find the path that will allow them to get there and will enable them to actually be capable of working in that type of a role. Simultaneously, I think a good screening process will identify who is actually capable today of hitting the ground running, because that's what lean IT shops need, are people who can step in and hit the ground running in these areas of opportunity that a company has a need for.
Well, and let's address a different part of the market. If a person were an IT, potentially an IT staff person, or they believe, and they didn't have a job, should they be talking to you?
Absolutely, or my team. If they were an IT professional looking for work with an IT background, they should apply at RHI.com.
Uh-huh. Okay. And I mean, rather than just blow it out onto Monster so that anybody that had IT in there as a keyword gets their resume, they could additionally, they could be speaking to you, and you could be a little more targeted for them.
One of the advantages of working with a staffing firm is having an agent on your behalf as a candidate who's looking for work. The advantage from a client side is a good IT staffing firm is going to go through the screening process to identify who is capable of hitting the ground running. And so if I were an IT professional out of work, I would want to leverage the use of an IT staffing firm or multiple IT staffing firms as a means, one more tool in the tool belt to finding a search, and as a means of creating those informational interviews that will help eventually land you the real job.
Now, if I'm an IT staff person and you find a job for me, do I pay you?
No, absolutely not. So if you're an individual looking for work, a IT staffing partner working with candidates and clients should be free to the candidate side experience. There's obviously a fee charged to clients for sourcing and identifying quality talent for their teams. But for a candidate experience at Robert Half, the candidate experience is always free.
And they can sign up again where?
They can sign up if they're a technology candidate at RHT.com.
RHT.com. Dave, what questions would you have of Kelly?
Well, I wanted to ask, I think I have an opinion on this, but I wanted to see if the CIOs, if you're finding that CIOs, because of the economy and because of the funding levels, tend to be a little bit more risk averse. They can't afford to make hiring mistakes, and by using a firm such as Robert Half Technologies, are they able to, you know, mitigate their risk and hire the right, you know, the right person the first time, and if that's a trend that you're seeing?
Absolutely. I believe that CIOs know that having the right resources in place is a big step in the right direction for addressing the concerns that are keeping them up at night. Having the right team in place with the right people on the team that can create effective processes and procedures helps to minimize risk around data security and minimize risk of updating operating systems or hardware. So certainly making sure that your teams are appropriately staffed for the workload levels and making sure that the right players are on the team and are functioning in a producing capacity helps the team minimize their risk.
And very good. Go ahead, Will.
Kelly, did you have any questions of Dave?
Absolutely. I would love to know, as you're looking at IT outsourcing, what the market has been like for you and what your experience when you're approaching clients today is like.
What we've seen is that there's increasing acceptance of the need to outsource certain functions, certain IT functions, particularly those that are seen as being not strategic to the business. So the what I will call the janitorial service of IT, the day-to-day administrative tasks that really don't speak to the competitive advantage that a customer has, but that must be performed. And in the past, there's always been an acknowledgement that it would be good to reduce costs in those areas and focus on core competencies. But the economy has made that a much more urgent initiative to follow through on. And so what we're seeing is an acceptance by the market of certain outsourced services, in particularly the network management.
Now, Kelly, I'm looking at some of the graphs that – well, by the way, where could people get this report from you?
If they go to www.rht.com and look at the resources section, they can see that report.
Excellent. Now, on the report, what I'm seeing is that I'm amazed 65% of the CEOs you talked about estimate that the average company experiences 3 or more IT security breaches per year. Do you find that to be astounding?
That was surprising, but I think that when you look at the totality of what's considered a security breach, 65% makes sense.
Dave, do you find that to be true?
Oh, yes, we do. And because there are many things that would be considered a security breach, loss of a backup, inability to restore a network, as well as the theft of a laptop. So if you have a laptop that has sensitive personal information on the laptop and that laptop is stolen, even if the information is not released to the public, it's still considered to be a security breach. And there are more regulations, and just there's more concern and visibility that these events get today.
Well, now, Dave, if somebody used, and you know, Dempsey Bluvar is a good one. If somebody were to use an outsourced provider like Dempsey Bluvar, would that reduce their security breaches?
In theory, it should. The service provider is in the business of providing services in a secure manner and protecting data. And the service providers will have a service level agreement with certain guarantees, and so certainly a CIO can use this as part of their overall risk reduction strategy.
All right. Now, I also noticed that 37% of CIOs plan to implement hardware or software upgrades in the next year. That seems to me a tremendous market when we're talking about being in a recession. Were you surprised by that, Kelly?
No. I think that the salespeople who are listening know that many clients have been experiencing budget freezes and technology freezes, and 10% of the CIOs on our panel said sufficient budgets to fund IT projects were their top concerns. So I think those numbers go hand in hand. I think when you look at the budget freezes over the last 2-3 years, it becomes a necessity to upgrade hardware and software for companies this year and going into the next year.
So we're coming to the end of that cycle, and now it's necessary, not necessarily to get some sort of strategic advantage, but simply to stay in the game.
Absolutely.
Would you agree with that, Dave?
Oh, yes. And what we're seeing at one event is the end of life of Microsoft Windows XP as an operating system. And Microsoft has its past end of life, and organizations are moving to Windows 7. They need to do so to support new applications and new security requirements. And along with the upgrade to Windows 7, the question is, do you upgrade computers in place that have already been depreciated? It turns out that to do an operating system upgrade on legacy hardware is a pretty expensive proposition, and so that upgrade usually includes an upgrade of the computers, the hardware as well.
Well, Dave, can you can a service provide, does a service provider assist a company in planning that upgrade and executing it?
Yes, certainly. So it's pretty typical that when going through an upgrade, an organization doesn't have a chance to do this kind of an upgrade. It can be a pretty disruptive upgrade, and they don't get a chance to do that very often, whereas service providers have the experience and the methodologies in place to assist with the upgrades, whether they're helping in the planning of the upgrade or actually helping with the deployment. So we see that even very large organizations that have extensive IT staffs will typically use an outside provider to at least assist in the planning of an upgrade, if not part of the deployment.
Good. Okay. Well, this has been very interesting to me, and I think it's going to be very helpful to people listening. Sometimes we end the show by giving the guest the microphone and a minute. So let me give you each in turn the microphone and a minute, and it's your opportunity to tell the listeners anything that you'd want to tell them about business and what you see coming, or help them to find out what they need to thrive in this economy. So, Dave, why don't you start? You got the microphone for a minute.
Well, thank you very much, and I appreciate having had the opportunity to participate. I would say that what we are seeing is an improvement in the economy. We're seeing hiring start to increase, and there's certainly a lot of pent-up demand to execute on projects that have been deferred, and I would say from a self-serving perspective that organizations like ours, Dempsey Blue Bar, and other organizations can assist in deploying those projects. And organizations like ours are able to assist organizations to perform the non-strategic tasks, the ongoing maintenance tasks that may be consuming the resources they currently have on staff, so that those resources can be freed up for more strategic initiatives. But again, I really appreciate the opportunity to participate today.
Great. So if somebody wanted to get in touch with you, Dave, what would they do?
They could see our website at DempseyBlueVar.com, 14 letters, D-E-M-P-S-E-Y, like Jack Dempsey the fighter. BlueVar, the color blue, BLUEVAR.com.
Okay, great. And then we'll pass the microphone on to you, Kelly. You got a minute and the microphone.
Thank you very much for giving me the opportunity to speak today. I'd say that the critical takeaway from the CIO Insomnia Project report is that CIOs do have a lot on their minds these days. As technologies advance, IT leaders are feeling greater pressure to update company infrastructure and to ensure balance between their full-time fixed labor costs and their variable and project-based needs. Many CIOs are sharing similar concerns, so I'd encourage those listeners who are listening today to visit the full report and video that are available online at rht.com. I'd also say from a Robert Half perspective, we specialize in the placement of skilled IT professionals who can serve clients on a contract and contract to hire as well as a direct hire basis. So should you be somebody who has a concern around your staffing model and looking for the right balance between that full-time fixed labor cost and variable or project need, we'd certainly love the chance to help, and you can find that at rht.com. Thank you again.
Excellent. Well, thank you both for being with us today. I really appreciate it.
Thank you, Will.
Thank you, Will.